This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about 1993 forgotten action classic Judgment Night. Directed by Stephen Hopkins, screenplay by Lewis Kulick, story by Lewis Kulick, produced by Gene Levy, and starring Emilio Estevez, Cuba Gooding Jr., Dennis Leary, Stephen Dorff, Jeremy Piven, cinematography by Peter Levy, music by Alan Silvestri, produced by Largo Entertainment, and distributed by Universal Pictures. This movie was made for $21 million, and it kind of tanked as it made only $12 million. How are you guys? How are you, Steve?
I'm great. How are you today?
I'm all right. I'm
good,
all right.
Good.
How are you, Ricky?
I am wonderful. How are you?
I'm all right, man. I'm all right. In this week's episode, we have a very special guest, the president of fear itself, the Crypt Keeper with a sexy voice, Mr. George Healy from Horror Weekly.
I'm honored. Thank you, gentlemen.
How are you, George?
I'm fantastic. How is everybody?
We're all good.
We're doing very well, especially after a 93 action flick that should have been a horror film, but wasn't.
Uh-huh. I sent a message to George.
Yes.
I was like, man, do you want something else? Can we still pull out? Is this going to be a 9-month pregnancy now, or do we have to go through with this?
No, I was perplexed for a minute because the podcast is Horror Weekly. It's not, you know, Action Weekly or Jeremy Piven plays Ellis in Die Hard Weekly. Like, so I was like, why am I on this episode? And then I realized that this director did only horror movies before this movie, right? So
that is not, you see, you think we are thoughtful enough that like an incredible amount of tension went into picking this movie. It really didn't. In fact, we didn't console Ricky. Steve just pulled this one out of his hat. He kind of had something here. And then as we are watching the movie and we're reaching out for our phones, all these factoids came out. But that's not what I was going with this. What I was going with this is an instance in which I really reached out to you. And the intention was, do you want to fucking watch something else? And you replied to me going, I can't wait to talk about this movie. And I'm like, we're fine.
Which is totally true.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. I was surprised. Let's just put it that way. But look, before we start talking about this, a quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what's this movie about?
In a world where there is nothing but gangs and Chicago, the Screen Divers meet up for Christmas, and this is what's going to happen.
That's true, actually.
I feel like this is prophetic to what's going to happen to the three of us when this December or January, whenever we hang out. And I think this is what's going to happen. And does that mean unbuzz Jeremy Piven? That's my question.
28-year-old.
That man gave cocaine a bad name in this movie. I mean, can I just tell you, it's very rare that there's a portrayal, like, not a happy portrayal of cocaine on screen, no. But this is among the worst. Like, it has to be the worst. It's like, don't do drugs, so you turn into a fucking idiot. That's the, which it's a good PSA, and that's all right. But it's, you know, I also, in my party years, I had a fun time on drugs. You know, it wasn't always bad. And watching this yesterday, I was like, holy shit, I know what's going on. Is this what happens? You know, when he's reaching for every appliance and that, which, by the way, that RV, so many fucking screens. So many screens. Little screens. Mid-size screens.
CRT television. Like a dish the size of the moon.
Yeah, it's like a small Death Star or something.
Yeah,
I
but no
really
GPS.
The product placement of the Nintendo Entertainment System that really put me back in those days.
I did it again, Ricky, because as soon as we saw the gun, I just added it, but I didn't. My Italian accent just came out unchecked, and I just went Duck Hunt, Duck Hunt, Duck Hunt. But yeah, well, see, it's still
Duck Hunt.
There.
I promise I was saying Duck Hunt right then, yeah.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, the real question is, when this happens, when this befalls the screen divers, when you get together, which one of you is going to hand over your entire wallet with your identification to somebody?
Oh, my God.
I said to Sally yesterday while we were watching this, this is why I don't keep a picture of you or the kids in my wallet. No one will ever know you guys exist when I get caught on a bender.
So
they'll
smart.
Fucking take your phone, though. They will take your phone, and those pictures will be in your phone.
You're
and
right.
If this is the future, they'll probably take your eyeball, because by then all devices will have, like, retinal scanning. They'll cut your fingers off.
Oh, yeah. And just use it wherever they go. Go like, beep. Mm. Oh, free data. Beep.
Imagine if we get to the point in which you need to use a different body part, a private body part, to unlock your phone, so that that doesn't happen.
My brain instantly jumped to a completely wrong
thing.
Get
rid of that dildo that I got molded the other day, then.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Is it a keychain? That's all right. That's all right. No, I've seen it. That's all right. So what was I going to say? You got nothing to hide. You got nothing to hide. This movie, Steve, man,
why'd
you pick this movie?
I picked this movie because the last time I saw it was in 1994 when it got released on VHS in the UK.
You said that so many times about every 90s movie.
No. Usually it would be in the cinema. This film never got released in the cinema in the UK.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. There you go.
You know, I had to reach out for
and it basically was Blockbuster.
It was a Blockbuster Video.
It was Blockbuster Video.
Oh, my, okay. But, A, I had to source a copy for us to watch. And as soon as I didn't check it, okay, we sat down, Steve comes around, I put it on. The title comes on screen, and right under it, right under Judgment Night, it's Judgment Night, but in German, and I would not dare to pronounce it. So I turned to Steve and I went, do you want to bet that I got a German copy? And when they started... It wasn't dubbed, and I was so disappointed. I would have watched the entire thing in German. I just does anyone here speak German at all?
No,
a little
okay.
bit.
Okay,
mein Deutsch ist scheiße. Yeah.
Okay.
No, but I have a feeling if I heard Emilio Estevez speaking German, I might understand it.
Man, we're going to talk about everyone's performance here, but I got to say, Dennis Leary. Mm. He was on fire in this period.
Thank the heavens for Dennis Leary.
It
did remind me of that Dennis Leary that we don't see that often nowadays. The 90s was full of that Dennis Leary. You couldn't get away from that Dennis Leary because he was on MTV. He had his comedy specials out. But this performance reminded me why everybody loved Dennis Leary at the time. Even if he was coked out of his brain for the whole performance, but still,
It kind of requires it almost for this character. So, you know, you could argue that he went method for it. But I didn't realize that the dude from fucking Everlast is in this.
Yeah.
I was about to say, and this is connected to the soundtrack, which we might talk about later on, that it felt like he was followed by the House of Pain.
Quite literally, he was. You know?
Also, there's so many beats where you kind of hear Cypress Hill in the distance.
Yes,
and then that track's kind of reused, and then it's in the end credits. Mm. So when you look at the track listing for the actual soundtrack, it's a killer soundtrack, but you barely hear any of it. Like, it's almost like ADR. It's like in the background, it's...
Talking
about wise choice, I think. Like you could have just been like, "We have a killer soundtrack. Let's put it in every scene." But it wouldn't have worked. It's better this way.
You think it would have been like a way to sideload and sell the soundtrack alongside the movie.
But... I think it just would have been too music video. One of the things I really ended up liking about this movie is how atmospheric it is. And if you load it up with music, you take away from the magic of what's happening on the screen. I mean, this fucking movie is beautiful.
Yes, yes, yeah. It is. However, and I know the shots that you're talking about the most, because when you see them here, they're like, it's a split diopter shot.
Yeah.
We saw that. And again, sorry, guys, but I need to bring this up. And Ricky probably knows this. George, if you've heard previous episodes of the show, you know that we've got beef with Mystery Man. A movie that once we liked and now we hate. As soon as a movie starts, we see a name on screen. Ricky's already laughing.
Yeah.
And it's Marilyn Vance. Marilyn Vance is a costume designer. She was all over the place. Super talented, super talented industry person. In this, she's the executive producer of the movie. So, I understand some of the wardrobe choices as well. Cuba Gooding is given like a full on
varsity jacket and leather waistcoat
and cowboy boots as well.
Yeah,
like, and cowboy. Yeah, but he's okay. I don't want to take it away from, because we were talking about the way this movie looks. All right, it does look great, and I think there's almost a disconnect at times, but when it does look good, it looks really good. And I looked at, what is it, Stephen Hopkins.
Hopkins, yeah.
And the DOP worked together several times.
Yeah.
And the running thread, to like with other works that popped up in our conversation when you guys weren't there, myself and Steve, immediately when we heard the music, I turned around to Stephen and went, he goes, can you hear the Predator tune? And I said, yeah, I can, but that's not Silvestri. That's James Horner. And then guess what? Who wants Silvestri. To say?
Silvestri.
It's the director of Predator 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't think that all of the score here is Silvestri's score, because it's guaranteed. Silvestri wouldn't plagiarize Horner's music. It's in here, man. It's right. Got to be, right?
Right.
Basically, Silvestri was the second audio guy on Predator.
What do you mean?
He worked on Predator under, but he didn't. There's a huge wiki about it.
As a composer? Yeah,
composer. Yeah. So it looks like he was either on site working on the soundtrack at the time.
Hey, I may be wrong. It's possible that the Predator theme was not by, because I'm getting confused with Commando.
Yeah.
Every time I put Schwarzenegger and a good theme, I think of that marimba going ding 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 ding.
But he did work on Predator 2.
He did.
Yeah, for as a composer.
What instrument were you playing there?
It's me playing the marimba but falling down the stairs. You're an asshole. All right, well, it's, what the fuck? When was the last time you saw anybody play the marimba, dude?
I don't know, but you're the...
No, that's...
Was that an Italian one? I'm not sure.
You got a new screwdriver.
La marimba. All right, you know what I was getting at with that anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So, composer for Predator 2 was Alan Silvestri.
It is Alan Silvestri. Okay, yeah. There you go. So
when we look at Alan Silvestri's work in the movies, everything from Avengers Endgame, just going to do that, Ready Player One, to Forrest Gump, which I was really surprised at because I didn't realize he'd done the...
Alan Silvestri's a giant, dude.
Yeah, exactly.
George, you were saying about the look of this movie.
So, it's just shockingly great looking in parts. Like, I try to track what movies are jumping into my mind as, like, comparisons, right? And, you know, when I'm going into Judgment Night starring Stephen Dorff and Emilio Estevez, like whatever, I'm not expecting the third man to be jumping into my mind, right? But like, there's that scene where they're emerging from under the sewage, you know, sequence, and it's just like fingers in the sewer grate, and then they pop their heads up and they're looking around the town like they're like little mammals hiding from the dinosaurs, right? And the shot is just like pure classic. I mean, it looks amazing, and it's in the middle of like some really seedy looking terrible backgrounds, right? So to make that look beautiful, the end conflict in the store, the colors when they're closing in on Dennis Leary and the showdown's happening, the colors look like John Wick. I'm like, what is happening? Why does the movie look so good for its time?
But there's an entire like hollow mirror confrontation, like a Bruce Lee movie, like the final showdown.
Well, they throw each other into every glass case ever built.
We were laughing our ass off because it didn't even do like a Naked Gun movie. It was like they hit. When you think it's going to stop, it just keeps going and going and going and going.
I just love the fact that they've got the beer boxes and you can tell straight away that they're empty. It's like.
Totally. I like the little insulting push that Dennis Leary gives Emilio Estevez at the end when he's got him crawling. He's doing like the Denzel Washington Training Day move where he's beating Ethan Hawke and he's about to throw him off the roof. And he's not even going to bother to do it because he has so much contempt for him. And Dennis Leary's doing the same thing, which doesn't make any sense because he's been losing to Emilio Estevez the whole movie. But like he's contemptuously standing over the guy, like whatever. It's kind of crazy how close up they would get with the cameras in this, right? Like, they were not afraid to zoom at all. They weren't afraid. They weren't trying to hide Dennis Leary's acting. Like, it's incredible.
But they did try very carefully to hide the stuntmen with bad wigs.
Yes. But there's this little push that Dennis Leary gives Emilio Estevez when he's on all fours. And he just taps him with his foot and pushes his head through the last piece of glass that hasn't broken. And I couldn't stop laughing. It was like, oh, I see one quarter of glass left. Let's push your head into it just for the hell of it.
You know, there's, you mentioned something about them running around the city like they were kind of trying to hide from dinosaurs, basically being helpless against like an apex predator, and it's a good comparison. One of the things that needs to be praised here is actually Leary as a villain, because I always liked The Ref, which came out a year after this. This year he, like I said, he was on fire. He was beginning to get work all at once. Like he was in Demolition Man, which was shot right before this. You know, a huge blockbuster at the time. Then after that, 2 years later, he was at the top of his game with Asshole on MTV, right? But throughout this period, I always saw him as it's a supporting. He leads this movie, man. He really, really does. And there's one sequence in particular that highlights him being a predator here, like an actual apex predator. And one of the things that I couldn't help but think of, other than What I just kept thinking about is a wolf, because there are two packs, right? And he's leading one of the packs. Yes. There's a moment, right, I think it's my favorite sequence in this movie, is not only we see Jeremy Piven die off, finally, because I couldn't stand his character. We know that that's coming, by the way, a mile off. Like the moment they go into the apartment and there's the entire thing about him pointing the gun at his friends, you know he's going to be the first one to die. Because you need to completely fall out of favor with the character, because he's going to die next, right? So you know it's coming. But that entire bit, you really see, I mean, that the hatred that, what's the name of this character, by the way? Dennis Leary was called Fallon.
Yes. That's now, Liz Fallon. Ray or Razor, I think was his nickname, was Jeremy Piven.
But there you go. But Fallon is a crime lord. He's like ruling over his land, basically, which is the projects. You know, it's the remnants of the, I think we read it online as 1968 milk riots. Is that what it was? Yep. And that left parts of Chicago in complete destitution. So what happens when something like this happens? When infrastructure falls apart, crime takes over. So he's lording over this territory, right? Someone has entered his territory. So as much as he has disdain for anyone that comes from a different like socio-economic bracket, because he does, he really, really hates them. And this is reiterated later when he actually hates Frank's preppy name, which is Francis. He's like, he goes, Francis? Like, did I get to this point with someone called Francis? And you'll see how upset he is by the entire thing.
Totally. One of the first things we hear him call out is the license plate on the RV.
Yeah.
Like, he identifies what neighborhood they live in. It's like his first words in the movie. He hates all of that. Totally.
He hates all of that. And there's the bit when he's basically giving like a full sense of security to what's his name? Jeremy Piven's character is called
Ray,
right? Know immediately that this is just toying with his. He's basically playing with his food. Yeah. That's what this is, you know. And you said it. The cameras are really close. Like there's just the shots are so close. There's so many close-ups in this, and Larry's eyes in that sequence are terrifying. Like you know exactly.
Yes.
You know exactly what's going to happen later, but it's not telegraphed. You're still kind of on the edge of your seat. Mm-hmm. I wasn't expecting this movie to do this to me. Like, I was expecting a very vacuous, hollow action movie. And I'm not saying that it isn't. It is, and it's a bit of a mess.
Yeah.
But it was also surprising. It was also too long. We're going to discuss that. But mm-hmm. that was my favorite sequence. My favorite sequence is just to find out that Larry, at some point in his career, played a memorable villain. This is a memorable villain.
I'm just curious what everyone else's favorite sequence is, if they know him.
Oh, okay. For me, it's quite a hard one because, of course, the scenes in the sewers were really well shot and it did really ramp up the suspense and the dread. But I've got to say, the one that really caught my attention straight away was in the train yard. And when they're in the caboose and they're slowly being surrounded by homeless people. And it turns into that whole thing of a little bit of cat and mouse, as well as who's gonna chop them in first? Who's gonna say, "Oh, they're over here," because they like rather have the money. And then, but leading on to that, the whole them escaping out of the caboose, and it's just loads. It's just all. I know it wasn't that many, but it felt like a sea of homeless people that they just merged into and disappeared. It was really well shot, you know, and they used a crane shot. And I was going to say, like, a lot of the intense scenes, they used rudimentary gimbals to, like, get the camera really in and have these Steadicam shots, which now we take for granted Steadicam shots. Everything has a Steadicam shot. Everything's a little bit shaky or held by a cameraman. But these shots were really well maintained, and you just followed these actors really smoothly through this whole film.
Yeah, and that's a really dark setting, and you could see it, which wouldn't if it was, this was made in 2025, the whole scene would be black.
So one of the things that when they got the dailies, they were saying, is this a matte painting? Because it was so, how they've structured the shots and how the lighting has fallen on those shots. The actual, did you pay for somebody to do a matte painting in the background? It's like, no, this is what was shot straight to film.
I think I watched a couple of interviews and apparently the cast hated this.
Oh yeah.
The entire cast hated like acting in this movie. The entire production was a nightmare. Apparently it was Chicago. I haven't been to Chicago. Steve, you live there. Yeah. You know, it gets cold and damp. And apparently it snowed as well. So that had to be cleared for continuity as well. Yeah. Not to mention the newspaper budget in this.
It's huge.
Fucking newspapers flying around everywhere.
Okay, I'm gonna mention this right now because a lot of those scenes are actually filmed in L.A.
They are?
So, yeah. So
careful, because that's George's hometown.
Okay, I'm going to say we get to see Paddy's Bar. From from Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Did you just fucking click your pant twice?
Yes, I did. and it's at 22 minutes and 12 seconds. We get to see Paddy's Bar, which is filmed in LA itself.
Isn't there like a warehouse?
Technically, it's a front end. It was a bar originally.
It was a bar originally. Yeah, okay, I thought it was like a storage warehouse.
So there's parts of this which are filmed in L.A. There are parts of this which are filmed in Chicago. The parts I picked up in Chicago straight away was when we got to see the transit system, so the above sections. And I was just like, that's Chicago. And one of the things that we have to kind of talk about is because they're coming from... Chicago's notorious for having a very big motorway separating the poor and the rich sides. The socioeconomic divide is kind of seen there. And what we get from
the situation.
Don't you think that
like, they got gentrified now a little bit? Because this is 30 years ago.
We're talking about Capri Green, which obviously Candyman, which is a... Yeah, so we've got that kind of reference in there as well. So and the amount of films which have been shot in Chicago itself, you know, huge amounts. But what we get is that kind of divide, but they don't mention it. So they're aware of it, but they don't mention it. This is something which...
And I'm glad they don't, because
actually,
they really don't know the area.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, not to mention the fact this movie takes place over a period of 8 hours. That's it.
Yeah.
And
but it feels like longer.
Yeah, it does feel fucking longer. But anyway, that's a different story. Right after we finish this, we really wanted to talk about the movie, and it's a golden rule that we don't until we record. So I said to Steve, "Get the fuck out of my house, otherwise we're going to talk about this movie."
Yeah,
he goes, "Are you okay?" I'm like, "Get out, just go, because otherwise we're going to have to talk about it."
I was putting my shoes on at that point.
Yeah,
but,
I know. I love to throw you out, though. That's what it is.
I did want to bring up my favorite part, because we're on that section, which is when Fallon's droning Travis.
That entire section
about, you know what, I hate whiners, you know? It's like that kind of really just visual straight on his face. And we're getting to see him just like frustratingly just doing that.
It's the... how he needs to finish the story.
Yeah.
He's telling a story. The guy's already dead.
Yeah.
And he's...
Yep. He's fucking partner, yep.
The other guy in his crew goes, he's not getting up. But he doesn't care because he needs to finish the story.
Yeah.
So that the last person of his crew fucking hears it. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Am I mistaken?
That's a great scene. It was like he was possessed while he was doing it.
He's a memorable villain in this.
I'm going to say that in itself is horrifying. You know, the fact that he's like that one to...
He looked a little startled when Everlast told him the guy was down. He's dead. I had something bigger on my mind than his life. It's chilling.
Peter Green, Zed's dead, baby.
Zed's dead.
You know what? You know what fucked that guy's career? You know what fucked that? Michael Wincott. Every time I see him, it's like it's the same type of... Am I wrong here? Am I wrong?
No, you're right.
Interchangeable. Both of them are great.
Sally thought it was William Fichtner.
No. See, there you go. You're adding on. You know, it's like the Bill Pullman...
Bill Paxton.
There are two actors from that era that kind of interfered with each other's careers. And that's Bill Pullman and... Help me out.
Well, you got to name a movie that we can confuse them in.
So, Dumb and Dumb, the other guy.
Jeff Goldblum. No, Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Daniels. Jeff Daniels.
Going down the right avenue.
There was am I crazy here, or it was a period in which it was easy to confuse the two? I don't know why.
Very easy.
Yeah, so,
by the way, about Bill Pullman, we need to do Zero Effect.
Oh,
at some
God.
Point, because
don't pick him now. Don't pick
why?
The film now.
Why?
You're gonna then try and text me or phone me and be, can we change the film like a day before recording?
This is the show.
The process.
And plus, I had to throw Bill Pullman into the mix, man. George is a huge Lynch fan,
right?
Yes.
Okay. I think Pullman.
Yeah, the last time Bill Pullman could have been in this movie, he's intimidating.
Yeah. I'm just going to say this. Umba sent me the link to David Lynch's estate sale.
What, David Lynch estate sale?
Yeah.
And oh my God, I was looking at the prices of the synthesizers and I was just going, oh shit.
apparently, you could buy his espresso machine.
The starting price is $2,000 to $3,000 American. No.
Yeah.
Can I tell you something? I sent you the link. I didn't fucking look at it. So you guys looked at it.
My single favorite thing post I saw about that was someone, I forget his name, put up a post. It was a picture of a box of David Lynch's power tools. He captioned it showing up at the construction site and telling everyone Lynch owned these tools. And I'm going, okay.
We're building ideas today.
I was just thinking with the power tools, because of obviously it's in the section, I was just like, so technically you could murder somebody with David Lynch's power tools and get him to be the guy.
You could fix the gutter or hang a painting, but you went straight for
murder.
Okay. I saw a dream catcher. Can you imagine the dreams that thing caught? Like, holy
oh my God. And so many scripts.
Yes.
So many scripts.
Yep.
Going back to Judgment Night.
Just real quick, my favorite sequence to tie a bow in that was when he's negotiating with the gang that saw them run up into the building.
Nice.
The two gang leaders sort of approach each other and they have this incredible exchange, right? Where Dennis Leary pulls him aside and says, if we screw with each other in front of our troops, this is going to escalate, right? So just tell me, how much is this going to cost me? And the kid's like, if I want your money, I'll take your money. And Dennis Leary's like, you can't take my money, but you can take my money.
That's phenomenal.
And the line delivery of that. And then when he hands him the money, it's got blood on it. And the kid goes, there's blood on your money. And he's like, have you ever seen any that didn't?
Yes.
Blood on it, right?
Yeah.
And just that exchange for some reason was so electric. And not only were the line readings amazing, but I've been so impressed by Dennis Leary through the whole movie just by the look. Like, they'll do shots of him where he's just standing looking down or, like, you know, figuring things out. And he's not even saying anything. And the body language acting is phenomenal, right? But in this scene, it was believable, right? That these two people, because the whole movie, Jeremy Piven's talking about all these fake negotiations that aren't real negotiations. He's basically just lying to people. Like, he conned someone to get the RV. He's lying to his friends about whether he has guns or working phones, like whatever, right? And he keeps talking about we're businessmen. He turns to Dennis Leary and says, we're both businessmen, which is bullshit. But this scene, that is two businessmen. Right, one of them's really young, but Dennis Leary and that kid like work it out, and then it's a really short, small scene, but I thought it was amazing.
There's a little bit of misdirection as well. I don't know if it's that or bad writing, but that's when plausibility started flying out the window, and I thought, okay, this movie's not about that, because if I start doing that, then I'm gonna hate it. But again, thank God for Dennis Leary, because otherwise I would have focused on that and it would have ruined the entire experience entirely.
Yep.
It's right at the beginning, right after they hit the guy, and you don't see the red herring right away, right? He kind of spots it, but you're meant to not respect the character from the get go, so you don't take it at face value that's what it is. If anything, you skirt around it. Factual, which is this is obviously a red herring. It's not, they didn't really hit him. You know what I mean? Like, but you don't want to pay attention to Piven's point of view at all from the get-go. But then he does something so fucking stupid, and I thought, man, I actually liked Jeremy Piven, and now I can't even say that he acted this role so well. Maybe the writing was shit, but there's one sequence in particular at the beginning, which is right before he calls 911, which he goes through. He does call 911 and then hangs up. He takes a huge sip of vodka, and I just thought, what the fuck? Like, this is actually not making sense in the script either, because let's say that you're calling them, not calling them, or whatever, your first concern, and I know I'm right, because right after he hangs up on 911, he fucking scrambles to get rid of all of the alcohol, but it just took a massive swig of a bottle of vodka, and I just thought, what the fuck? Who wrote this? And why is it there? You know, it was a bad note, and it was right at the beginning. Plus, I was distracted by other stuff.
which there's a lot of like attempts to create some kind of meaningful Chekhov gun in this. It's a shame because when we see the NES, that's full on just product placement by Nintendo. Because at one point I thought, you want to bet that they're going to use that fake Duck Hunt
gun,
gun as a like make it look like it's a real gun, but it's not, and it doesn't happen, which is a wasted opportunity. The other thing is the, and I thought it was underused. Somehow visually it really works. It's the fucking, there's a shot, an exchange between Piven, and it's really the one of the first bits of, you know, tension in the RV. Emilio Estevez is right in the middle of the frame, and right to the left side of the frame, there's the fucking the torch, the lamp, or whatever the hell it is, a yellow torch that is on the wall of the RV, and you know it's going to be used later because it adds it was so much in the forefront of the shot that I thought it's so prevalent, it's the equivalent of a wedding ring in a character that is going to do something and the union needs to be highlighted, so all of a sudden you see the wedding ring on their hand, you know what I mean, it's that kind of thing.
Of course.
And to go back to what Ricky was praising earlier, that shot, the first crane shot we see in this, is almost wasted. It's like end of the movie kind of shit. It's a beautiful crane shot, and it happens later. It happens at the beginning of the third act of this movie that they use this crane shot, and it's phenomenal. But you could have ended the movie like that. They just walk into the night, and it was such a closer, and I just thought, what the fuck? Why are you using it now? Why are you doing this now? Anyway, Ricky, you wanted to jump in about the gun.
No, I wasn't going to jump in about the gun. I was going to jump in about the script, because I think you've pointed out something that is very evident. If you look at the history of this film and its script, this went through so many rewrites, so many hands, so many people adding bits, removing bits, and whatnot. One thing I thought was going to happen, and I admit that I completely forgot I'd seen this film until it got to the bit where the RV got stuck in the alleyway, and I was like, I've seen this film, was the fact that I thought that Dennis Leary's character would be part of the police. I don't know what it was, but there was something in me that said, they're going to phone the police. The police are going to turn up, and he's going to be like, a special detective or whatever he is, and he's just going to shoo them away, and that's going to add another level of, we can't even get the police because
it's a no way out situation.
No way out situation.
I agree with you because I thought that's what was going to happen when they're chasing after the cops with the fuck. I thought you want to bet that's them. But that's a good juxtaposition, right? The fact that you're chasing for help and instead you're chasing your whoever's pursuing you. Mm. And it's a shame they didn't go through with that because that would have been also funny.
And one of the hands that supposedly were asked to look over the script or work on it was John Carpenter, which is interesting because there was definitely a little bit of assault on Precinct 13 about this script. That was definitely a little bit of the Warriors about this script. You know, there's so many little things about this that felt like it was that bygone era of 80s B-movie.
You know what this is? Funny. The plot of this movie is a 70s plot. It was written in the 80s and it got made in the 90s.
Actually,
and that's the way it feels. Because it's the fucking Warriors, dude.
I'm just going
to
say this.
It is the Warriors. They're trying to get from one side of town to the other and survive. Like, it's...
Yep.
And there was a little bit of interplay among them going, who can you trust now? There's like... It's a shame. If it got made when it was written, because I think it was written in 89, this would have been a classic.
Mm-hmm.
Complete classic.
Okay, so the original script, which is actually not by anybody who is... was created a long time, 1970s, and it was Richard DiLello,
go again because I'll edit this and I'll so Richard, whenever you get it right,
DiLello.
No, go like this with your hand, do this.
Richard
DiLello. Riccardo DiLello. Riccardo
DiLello.
Mamma mia.
Ricardo, hands.
Right. Richard DiLello, whatever.
I have failed you, Steve.
I know.
15 years of fucking friendship. You can't even throw your hands in an Italian manner. It's my fault.
Nah, fun culo.
I have failed you. Ti ho fallito.
Oh, it's hang not on, your guys. Fault.
It's not your fault.
Static.
It's not your fault. That's it. Is your fault.
No, we're going to fix this mic thing that's happening.
That is your fault.
There you go. Ooh, fantastic. I'm back.
Don't touch it. Don't touch it.
It's because I hit it with my hand.
That's what she said.
While...
don't move. Just
okay.
Wait.
So,
wait. Sorry. Okay.
He originally scripted a load of stuff for Sean Penn and Bad Boys.
What was the name of the writer again?
Richard Delalio. Come on, you can see it. Delalio.
Can you send me a text message now?
Vafunkul.
Okay, I have no fucking idea what his name is. What is it?
D I L E L L E O.
Just send me a fucking
D-I-N-G-O-N-B. Okay. His name,
dude, I need to edit the show anyway. So you send me the text.
Just right? I'm not even going to send you a text. I'm going
to
send you.
I'll fucking read it to you, and then you say it.
Yeah, here you go. Here's the process, okay. George.
This is amazing.
My God.
It looks like he's taking a picture of you on my screen.
Did you take a picture of the name? You could have fucking texted me that.
Yeah, I'm not going to text you.
Oh my God, it's got nothing to do with all the shit you were saying.
You best keep this in. You best keep this in.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Dude, you kept saying you best keep this in like Sally wants a third kid. Can I just say? All right, Steve, you ready?
Yeah.
Richard?
Yes, Richard.
Delello. Oh my God.
Delello.
Okay, go again. Okay. So,
the original script is by Richard Vafunkulu.
Just say it in an accent. Get it over and done with.
The original script is by Richard Diallo. That's the best I'm going to do, guys. I'm not Italian.
Okay,
like
that's
Umba.
Great. Let's fucking clap for him.
And
one more time, let me hear the music.
There's going to be edited music at some point. And it's probably going to be something to do with
music in there.
Italian.
There's some Italian accordion.
Yeah. Come on, do it.
All right, come on.
But it was originally wrote in 1979, and it was titled Escape. And it was picked up.
No shit.
Yeah. And it was. And it's more. It was a more dirty, dark horror vibe to it.
Oh man, this gets you know.
It has a little taking of Pelham 1-2-3 in there. I think
exactly. Yeah.
Did you see the nods? I was expecting George to point this out to us, because actually that goes nowhere. That turns into a nothing burger, and it was a little heavy-handed. There's the bit where Cuba Gooding Jr. and Stephen Dorff are on the ground.
Yep.
In this little cupboard space or whatever. It's full on like Laurie Strode and Michael Myers kind of thing. And I thought that's where, you know, there's going to be a little bit of interplay here. No, nothing.
Yep. No.
They didn't play with that. Anyway,
The best jump scare is at the end with the pistol barrel coming in the screen. Like at the very end into Emilio Estevez's head. It's the only time I jumped.
And you're expecting it's going to be Leary, but it's not.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Mm.
I gotta say, Estevez was so fucking good in here, man.
Yeah,
well, Cuba Gooding Jr. is really good in this as well.
Okay,
it's very expressive. Like.
Okay, Ricky, you go for this because you know the story about this part.
Story about this part is that this originally should have been John Travolta in the Emilio Estevez character, and it was meant to be Kevin Spacey. I think it was Kevin Spacey.
Kevin Spacey,
Dennis Leary.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm glad that didn't happen.
To push it further, it was a lot of other people from... I mean...
This actually feels very much like Platoon, because you know how Charlie Sheen was like at the very bottom of a list to an extent that he had to fight for the part, and then he had to wait a couple of years, and then the movie got remade, and then they picked Charlie Sheen. Same thing happened with Emilio.
But you know what it is? Yeah. Kevin Spacey doesn't need a gun to be menacing, and it's a cocktail party and no witnesses.
Yes. Ooh, where's that chocolate cake?
Oh,
sorry. That was harsh.
Oh. You want chocolate cake for breakfast?
All right.
I'm gonna milk. You know what? There's a meme that goes around that there was a 10-year-old comedian, and her big joke was, "It's really hard being on the dating scene. I date one person, and they go straight to jail."
A 10-year-old comedian?
Yeah, supposedly there's a meme going around, and I thought, actually, that's brilliant, but dark.
I'm sorry I took us to Michael Jackson territory. Let's get the fuck out of here. Let's moonwalk.
Yeah. Let's
back
escape.
To this movie. Escape. Yes. What were you saying? Yes. What were you saying, Riggy?
I'm sure I was saying lots and lots and lots about this film.
No,
I'm
you
sure
were talking about you were talking
well,
about
you were talking about the different role choices. And I like that Dennis Leary is the pick. I gotta confess, you know, especially coming from the horror side of it, I wanted his character to be a little more frightening, more like Johnny Depp in Black Mass or some kind of like that kind of feel to it, you know. But I don't think that was his performance. I think it was the writing of the character, right? They when you have, it's like what happens to Freddy Krueger. He gets less scary the more one-liners you get, right? Like Dennis Leary, they were writing it so that he was having too many one-liners to be as scary. Like part of why Johnny Depp's performance of Black Mass is so intimidating is he doesn't say a lot.
But if you didn't have Dennis Leary saying, like that big verbose scene where he's cutting down Ray, just, if it wasn't Dennis Leary saying it, and if it was Kevin Spacey saying it, it probably wouldn't have hit as hard. But Dennis Leary just has that menace. He has that comedic timing, just like Bill Burr. He can turn anger on within a second.
It's funny that you just, you know, it's another Rage comic, obviously. But the idea is that if it was, I actually thought exactly about him. Like, that's where I went. I went. What if this role was being casted today? The only other person that could have played this was Bill Burr. But the thing is, he wouldn't take a role like this anymore because he's moving away from that.
Right.
You know, there's a point to that rage in his act. There's a point to that rage in the characters that he plays. I mean, his latest portrayal, which was a beautiful sequence. I don't know if anyone remembers from The Mandalorian. There's a confrontation with another Imperial soldier at the table. And he flashbacks to... George, have you seen this?
No.
I'll send you a clip for our listeners. If you have seen the episode in question of The Mandalorian, Bill Burr's phenomenal in it. And it's like, it's not even his performance, but it's a casting director. It's the person that went, you know what, you need to play this character. That nailed it. Absolutely nailed
so,
it.
So, Disney, send us some bucks for that.
I would actually say that Bill Burr's been doing that for a while, because even in The King of Staten Island, which... none of us should watch, but anyway.
No, I actually liked it.
That was really touching. His whole character was really touching, because you start off going like, oh, here comes Bill Burr. He's going to cut him down to size. And then as it carries on, the character really develops. And I really think that Bill Burr could be another person. And, you know, let's hope that everything goes well for him, for Glengarry Glen Ross on Broadway, because that will just be another step into this whole serious territory of acting.
Another movie which was shot in
Chicago.
You guys
know what I'm going to see tonight?
What?
I'm going to see John Lithgow.
Oh.
The giant. He plays Roald Dahl. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Mm. Anyway.
How much did that cost you?
Your
arm? Your leg?
No.
Four of those board games behind you?
No. Not this time, because we didn't. In fact, I was a little bit concerned. Because normally when we go to the theater, we pick up like second row or third row. And those tickets are usually like 80 quid, 100 quid. In American dollars, that's $120, $130, which is good, okay, if you get them on time. But if it's for a performance like this, I wish I was in second row. I'm not. We got tickets in balcony, but guess what? I found this site online. You put the name of any theater, and there's a community that will post photos. So you put in the name of the theater, you put in the number and the section where you're sitting, and there will be photos from other people that have sat there that show you what the view is like.
Yeah. Yep.
And I checked today, and these dog shit tickets that are like equivalent to like $40, they said for the, I've seen the giant there, it's fine because it's a one man show kind of thing. It's
that's
mainly
great.
One man show, but I can't wait. He's one of my favorite actors. So
I will just say, anybody who visits Sydney and you get anything in the Sydney Opera House auditorium, the main one where the orchestra plays from, any seat is wonderful.
The acoustics are amazing.
Not only the acoustics, but just visually, everything's like domed up.
That's
beautiful.
You're talking about the Opera House, the Sydney Opera House.
Yeah, dude.
I fucking cried in that place.
Good.
I cried.
Enjoy.
There was no like. Okay, wait a second. I'm a sensitive man. All right, but I cried because it was a 40 piece orchestra. It came from nowhere. I had a response in which I touched my face. And water was coming out. It wasn't an emotional response. It was a physiological. My body reacted.
Beauty. The last time I was there, I'm going to be there in a week, I think. But the last time I was there, I saw Ben Schwartz doing his.
Well, I hope you didn't cry because he's a comedian. So
No. He came out and almost cried immediately because of the acoustics and just everybody was already cheering. So loud in there and it's beautiful. But anyway,
that's crazy. And if anyone comes to L.A. and goes to the Hollywood Bowl, there are lots of bad seats. So use the thing online where you can see the view because there are seats behind pillars.
I am so glad I didn't fork out half of my savings just to go see Maynard there. Talking of Maynard.
You're going to bring up that.
You're going to bring this on. The soundtrack is amazing. The reason why it's amazing is because what they did was they took the alternative and heavier music groups of the time and mixed them with rap or alternative rap groups at the time. So De La Soul's in this, Helmets in this, Cypress Hill, Sonic Youth, Pearl Jam are in this. What you may not know is that actually Rage Against the Machine and Tool did a track together just for this soundtrack, which the producers said, nope.
Yeah. I'm going to have to put it on the show, right?
Yeah, it's there's a YouTube.
The track is amazing, and saying this. It's called Revolution, but it's got two names. I can't remember what the other one is.
Yeah.
But
wait a second. Did you say Rage Against the Machine?
Rage Against the Machine and
the track Revolution.
Yeah.
And mainly, it's untitled, but the titled version of it is Revolution or Judgment Night. Or whatever. It's just that the one of the main lyrical parts is Revolution.
Yeah. All right.
So that's how they used it.
Some you might find it on SoundCloud if SoundCloud still works.
It's on YouTube.
But
just hear YouTube. Tom Morello's fucking wah-wah going wah 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 wah.
Actually, it's more. It is more Adam Jones's guitar work. It's definitely a Maynard does the verses. Zach De La Rocha comes in during the chorus hits.
It is
a blinding track, but it was 7 to 8 minutes long. So it was a no-note on a CD.
Yep.
Nope.
Yep.
Can't fit this on. Nope.
Okay. Wow. Now, I don't mean to justify myself here. Now, there's no video element for our listeners, but I need to come clean about something, which is the guys may have seen that I was disconnected somehow from the conversation. I tried to remain engaged as much as possible, but I was also doing some research that I should have done before the show. There is a vehicle that is somehow more prevalent than it deserves to be in this because it gets fucking destroyed in the first act. Don't you want to know what it is? Because there's a very defined reason why we didn't see the branding of this fucking vehicle in full view. And I think there's a very specific reason why, but it's also very plausible. I read somewhere that car companies in general don't particularly like to have their vehicles being blown up or being in like horrific accidents because it projects, you know what I mean? So whenever that happens, and in fact, more recently, that happens in The Substance. I had to, in The Substance, it's obviously a Ford Camaro that she's driving, but they went out of their way to remove that. You really need to go frame by frame because the car that she has the accident with in that, it's a Camaro.
Yeah.
I found the Euro production or whatever. Then I discovered as well that Caroli Farjal went out of her way to pick that particular model because that particular model was recalled for safety issues.
Wow.
And in fact, it was a airbag. It was an airbag issue. Okay, that's why my entire theory, not my entire theory, but the theory that we talked about on our episode on The Substance, which I don't think it takes away from the story, in which anything you hear about The Substance happens post the accident. She's offered the substance by a dude that works with a doctor, just told her that she doesn't have a single scratch on her. And yet there's no seatbelt in that car. She's not wearing a seatbelt. The airbag doesn't go off. And then when I did the research, there was a production, like a series of these cars that had been made between a period of 3 years that had a problem with the inflator, the gas cylinders that inflate the airbags in those cars. Hence why Ford went out of their way to remove all identifiers in that shot. You can barely see it. You can barely see that it's a Ford. But in this instance, the RV in question is a Revcon King. American vehicle. Does it ring the bell at all, George?
Not really.
No. Just check it. It's like a custom vehicle, right? It doesn't have, there's no branding. There's no, I looked, man, and I couldn't find anything. And
no,
here,
you're right. There's no hints of what it is. I don't remember any of that. Yep.
There you go. It's a Revcon King, and in all the images here, there's no logo. On the front grille, there's nothing.
So just want to check.
That thing really, really blows up. So if that theory is true, it really explodes.
Yeah, you wouldn't want you know, your potential customers looking at your vehicles being destroyed.
It jumps into the air like it's a wounded animal. it bucks before it burns to the ground. That thing takes a beating.
Yeah. The entire set piece as well, how they're shooting those guns. Which I said the key word for Steve now is going to start going on about the guns.
No,
I
wanted to pick you up on.
I've never seen a movie like this, and then I'll give it to Steve, where guns that cannot be possibly shot one handed are fucking shot. We went so many broken wrists. So many broken wrists.
Yeah.
The guns are massive in this, and they just.
But before Steve starts,
I wanted to ask Umba something about a car. Was it a Lincoln?
Oh?
Was it a Lincoln?
Ah, you mean Fallon's car?
Yeah.
The gang's car.
Let's see.
He yells at them. He's like, you fucked up my car.
Yeah, George, you know what I'm on? You know about this.
Here we go.
There's we should get sponsored by these guys. Yeah. And this episode is brought to you by IMCDB. If you're not familiar with the Internet Movie Cast database, be the life of the party, man. All right, so the IMCDB is the equivalent of IMDB, but it stands for Internet Movie Cast Database, and you can key in details about, you can key in the title of a movie, and it will give you all the info about all the vehicles, the screenshots. Okay. So
I heard it gets used by Amazon Prime, Netflix, Disney Plus.
Are you mentioning
HBO Max?
Keep going.
Now, don't forget Disney.
It's not. The car in question is a 1988 Cadillac Brougham.
Oh, fantastic.
Brougham? Brougham?
How do you pronounce this?
George, are you familiar with this Cadillac?
I'm not, and I wasn't impressed with the car. That thing caved in with just a touch.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's fucking, and the RV is actually going over the same terrain, and it's still in one piece somehow.
And the RV went off at a 90-degree angle, even though it weighs 15 times the car. Like it was pretty hilarious.
Yeah, they don't make Cadillacs like they used to.
Oh, the bus lady, dude. The bus lady.
Oh,
later
the bus
on
lady. Like, fuck no.
I did really like the sequence where the RV got stuck and explodes, because it is such a quick, like, here's what all the characters are about moment, right? Like, Emilio Estevez's character, so Frank and Cuba Gooding Jr.'s characters are the only two who have any impact on that scene, right? He's trying to escape out the window, and Emilio Estevez is setting fire to it to cover their escape. The other two characters are doing nothing, right? And the other characters are going to do nothing the whole rest of the movie.
Oh, mate.
Right? Like, Ray's going to drag him down, and the brother is going to be incredibly passive, right?
Look, that's a massive element, and you really touched on a nerve there, but I have a problem with Stephen Dorff's character here. If there was somebody that was meant to spiral faster and display less empathy, it was him. Because you learn these things, right? You learn these things. This is at the age in which you have that vein of selfishness running through your entire fucking persona until something knocks it out of you. And here is the empath. You know, it's like, what the fuck? Like, you're a child.
He was supposed to be Christian Slayer.
Yeah, he was meant to be
interchangeable, definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
Especially at the time.
In this film, they wrote the script so that he would have the story arc of him mending things with his brother. And that's what his whole point is. It's like he was constantly put into situations of, is he going to run the opposite way or help his brother? And he constantly helped his brother to prove to his brother that it's actually worth a dime.
But it sucks because he's introduced a different way, right? He's the badass who pulls up, almost hits the RV. He gets into a road rage fight. He jumps out of the vehicle to initiate a road rage fight, right?
Yes, and he's the wild card, right?
He's the wild card. But then in the second half of the movie, he's the, I'll follow my brother along. I'm scared to intervene when the villains are approaching. Like, it doesn't make sense. His character arc is weird.
I gotta say, the best bit of acting in this movie by Estevez is the talk right after.
Yeah.
You know, when he talks to his brother, he goes, that actually, way he berates him is believable. He's saying, particularly in the States, right? Because we say over the pond, we always say that. Like, I wouldn't be able to have. No, I'm not saying that I'm not that unstable, but I'm glad that guns are not around because there are so many people that can have a fucking bad day. And sometimes. Yeah. You'll talk to somebody like you do online in real life. You never know when someone's just going to go, what the fuck did you say to me? Without the what the fuck did you say to me? It's just, that's it. You're one interaction away from meeting someone that is on the edge. Mm-hmm. And in that instance, that's mental. But it kind of, there was a sense of levity that came from the guy that comes out of the other car, the car in front, and goes, well done, man.
Yeah. That was amazing.
That's great. One of the best bits.
Every time I was going to give up on this movie, it did something special right after I was about to give up. Right? Yeah. Like the I don't like the way Dennis Leary's character dies. I think it's anticlimactic and stupid.
And also that shot, what the fuck? He circles around them like, why?
It was like a mess. But right after that, he has to go around and step over him, and that sequence was really effective, right?
Mm. Yeah. But you know what I thought he was doing? I thought he was going to get his wallet back.
Yeah.
Right.
And he doesn't.
He got it back anyway, though.
I think we're hitting the point of why this film is forgotten. And this film has so much amazing things about it that, like, even the setting is the same setting as Candyman. So you're sort of, like, looking around being like, what's going to jump out of this derelict room right now? But the issue with this film is that it seems to set up lots of things and lots of moments and lots of feelings that making the audience go, oh, this is going to happen next or that's going to happen next. And then it doesn't deliver. It just doesn't deliver. Even to a point where I thought Dennis Leary was going to have a Michael Myers moment. Because, you know, like, he's on
getting
the
up again, right? Because you're waiting for that.
You have that beautiful zoom in on his bloody face. And then nothing. Just it results into nothing.
The whole movie ends in nothing. The last shot is literally like a wall. The character just walks off the screen and the credits roll. Like,
it's also quite Naked Gun-ish again. Because he's walking by, he's walking next to a stretcher, right? That's the shot. Yep. Like, it's actually like it's a continuous take. He does that, he has the interaction with his brother, and then you can see him running. The cops look so fucking fake. The uniforms look so fucking fake. It looks like they got the fucking boom mic operator and another grip guy to just say, hey, put this on. Like, you're paramedic now. And the entire thing, but it's just how, and I just thought, first of all, he's clad in denim all the way through the movie.
Yeah.
And I never kind of enjoyed that shade of blue. It made me hate denim all over again. I don't know what it is. But he was the one that it was the most milquetoast. And I think it's out of the bunch, right? Even the way the movie opens. And in fact, Steve, you're not going to take this back. She was fucking right, mate. She was right, though.
She was right.
And I can't believe I'm white knighting
you,
now.
You were saying it
you.
As the film finished. You were going, she was right.
About what came out
she
of
was
your
right.
mouth. She's sitting there. They just had a kid, all right? He wants to go out with his friends, whatever. She just points out that, you know, it's kind of unfair because she hasn't been out either. And all of a sudden, Steve goes, that's the beginning of a toxic relationship. What are you talking about, man? Like, we don't know. We don't fucking know. We don't know. And all of a sudden, I'm siding with Emilio Estevez. Why am I siding with Estevez? I'm upset. No, with your statement. I'm upset with the fact that you made me fucking care for Denim, dude. Denim, dude. It's for Denim, dude.
No, you cared for Emilio Estevez. Come on.
I don't know. I actually thought of his performance in Maximum Overdrive being more emotive than this, which is not. It's not.
This is a variation on his Breakfast Club character, actually. Kind of.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah.
Yes.
Which is also filmed in Chicago.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. All Hughes.
All John Hughes.
We established this. All John Hughes movies are all based in Chicago. He's like
except
the Woody Allen of Chicago.
Except for the one film which he wrote and wasn't filmed there.
Which one?
We covered it. Pretty in Pink.
You don't? Pretty in Pink?
Yeah,
isn't Pretty Pink?
No. It wasn't filmed in.
Do we talk
Chicago?
But it's not John Hughes.
Are we?
It's written by him,
but he wrote the script.
My friend John Hughes. So are we wanting a 1 or a 10-star review here?
Welcome, Mr. Spader.
Which side would you like? Would you like the best, the worst? What side?
Let's go for the worst because.
Okay, so we're looking for 1 star. Okay, 1 star. Here we go. The dumbest movie in American history, maybe the world's. I gave up on the movie within half an hour after that, but the reasons was plentiful. The wind-up to In the Ghetto, yet the main danger to the existence is Dennis Leary, a white guy. I'm no racist, but come on. In anything resembling reality, and this film was trying to be an urban nightmare, Dennis Leary would not be trying to kill Emilio Estevez. He'd be hitching a ride to get the fuck out of Dodge himself. Thank you so much, Comic Sods, December 24th. So this guy wrote this on Christmas Eve. December 24th, 2001. Comic Oz. So it's spelled C-O-M-I-C, like a comic, but then K-O-Z. So I don't know if it's comic
K-O-Z
or comic cos. But
no numbers at the end of it?
No numbers. He got this.
You
got to
give him some credit.
You know what?
He owns comic cos.
He did write quite a chunk on the Winnebago, but you know, I just think him writing it on Christmas Eve.
All right, go all the way. Just go 10 out of 10. Let's see what tasteless asshole is out there. Please,
okay, 10 out of 10. Yeah. Let's go.
10 out of 10 is going to be fascinating.
It is. Okay, it starts with one of my favorite comments, famous quotes from Dennis Leary, which is, "Don't scream, don't move, don't whisper. Don't even breathe." So he has said that every time I wondered what the shit's going to happen next, how they are going to live another day to tell the truth about the crime scene, this movie was totally meant to be senseless. I believe that everyone of every age can see and enjoy this movie. The plot was very gripping and entertaining all at the same time. Mike is annoyed and confronted by John, then Frank takes the side of his bro for properly understanding the gravity of the situation. I wrap up it by saying it's as heart-pounding superb adventure of one night. Thank you, Amram PK, July 1st, 2008.
Oh my god.
Wow.
Fuck.
Was that AI?
I don't know.
Amram PK. AI in July 1st, 2008. Man, that must have been
time
shocking.
Traveling.
Bloody Terminators.
Did you see what happened? Did you see that Eddie Murphy and Martin Lawrence are going to be related?
Yeah.
Because they're.
Yeah.
I saw something going around on social media and someone said, no. Oh my, this looks like the beginning of a premise for a fucking utterly unbearable comedy. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be in laws. And there's no way they're not going to make a movie at some point, right?
Oh, right, right. I mean,
it's
naturally.
Well,
anyway,
they've made several in the past, right? Or am I just being silly? and not figuring that out.
It seems like they made something like that, but it's not. It's I don't think Martin Lawrence
was,
and...
Were they in Life? Was the film called Life?
Yes, they were together.
Yes, it yeah. was Life. Yeah,
they did that. Yeah. Now, it is time for... It is time for the ratings, I think.
All right. Are we writing them out? Or are we just saying them?
Yeah, I think we should write it out. We started doing this, George, because if we give the rating, I think we influence each other. So it would be nice. Write down your score. Only half decimal points are allowed. So 1.5, 2.5, 3.5, 8.5, 9.5, whatever. All right?
Okay.
Out of
10, right?
Yeah, out of 10.
Okay.
So in hindsight, I love this. I liked this movie when it came out. I wouldn't say I loved it, but I felt there were shortcomings. Watching it again recently, yesterday with Umba, I enjoyed the movie more. I felt it, the camera work was amazing. The color, the lighting. There were moments where, to refer back to a computer game, Resident Evil Nemesis, where you're constantly being chased.
Yeah, good point.
So you that idea of this urban horror, so to speak. I think it's better than I remember it to, than I kind of remembered it. But watching it has said that yeah, it's a good movie. I still rate it a 4. Because there's, it's too long. I'm going to rate it 4 Beretta 92 FS Inoxus, which is the gun which is taken out of the actual RV.
Okay. Okay. So that's Jeremy Piven's gun.
Yeah.
It's a what?
So it's a Beretta 92 FS.
Okay.
Oh, Inox.
Is that the only gun you want to talk about?
Well, it's the only one I'm going to rate. But if we want to talk about guns in general, okay. Eric Schroeder's using a Desert Eagle Mark I, one-handed, shouldn't be happening, as we've pointed out repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
Ruger P100, which was used by Fallon to kill the other guy. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the movie,
mm-hmm.
I can't remember his name.
Doesn't matter. He dies at the beginning.
But
the guy stole the money.
Sykes, which is done by Peter Green, is basically using a Smith & Wesson 19.6-inch partridge front sight.
That's the gun that Cuba Gooding is brandishing at the end of this movie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's actually the revolver in this, or the gun in this in general, that actually looks like it has the most kick out of the bunch.
It's a 6-inch heavy barrel.
You want to say that again, closer to the mic, please?
6-inch heavy barrel.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Sorry, I'm just going through my notes. So,
how much ammo do these weapons have? Because there's only one gun that ran out of ammo throughout this whole film. And it ran out of ammo at the precise right time.
Yeah, there's generally 6 barrels for 2 of the major weapons. Obviously, one Fallon reloads one of them. So, yeah.
Ricky, you're a piece of shit for encouraging this, I've got to say. All right? I fucking hate this part of the show. I know, Steve.
You know what? You should have taken my cue from the first time we do it and always have it as a segment and always start it with the Cowboy Bebop bounty hunter music. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for this.
It's all right. But we do forget the sawn-off shotgun.
Yeah. Yes. I rated it 8. For 8mm, because there's an 8. No, I'm kidding. My rating system is going to be a little different. Here's how I get to an 8. Right, there's all kinds of flaws with the movie. It's a mess. So a lot of the action choreography is terrible. A lot of the characters go nowhere, make no sense. Peter Green is fantastic. There's a lot of great stuff going on, but I can see all the flaws. The thing to me, though, is almost all the movies that are like this from that era have aged considerably worse than I remember them. And this movie is much better than I expected, right? I had never seen it before. But going on how it felt, the movies that were like it, the time it was made in, it felt to me like it was going to be like Stallone's Driven, but with Prime or something, right? Like it was going to be.
That movie is a car crash, pun intended.
Right, exactly. I thought it was going to be a terrible mess, and that the only good things would be possibly fun bad things, and then maybe a couple sneaky great performances like Dennis Leary. But what I got was a beautiful looking movie that in chunks felt like absolutely knew where to put the camera, knew how to make the visuals stay interesting, and there were just little touches that were they were polished for a movie that shouldn't feel that way, right? And I don't feel like any equivalent movie along this bracket from that time period that I feel like I would have seen like in Redbox, like, right, like this movie should have been. I feel like they're all going to be 3 or 4 rating points worse than I remembered it when I saw them when I was young. And this is the opposite direction. So I'm giving it extra points for momentum. Okay, so I would rate this 8 mostly broken suspended ladders out of 10.
Holy shit, man. Well done. Well done. Ricky.
Well, everyone, if you've listened to the show enough, I always rate my ratings on whether I'm going to watch this again. I'm afraid that even with the good acting from Dennis Leary, Cuba Gooding Jr., Peter Green, and even the minor characters, because I really loved all the scenes on the projects and them moving between buildings and meeting all these random characters, there was just something very disjointed about this film for me. And, you know, I can't see myself watching this again. So it has to be below a 5, but I am still giving it credit for all of the set pieces, the camera work and whatnot. But we've mentioned a lot of films that I would watch again over this. The Warriors, Taken of Pelham 1, 2, 3. Mm-hmm. Heck, even gritty British films like Harry Brown, I would watch again over this. So 4.5. Oh, this one's going to be difficult. But I had it and I've gone. Give me a second.
That's all right. I'll have to edit the show anyway. So
yeah, hold on.
Take your time.
Yeah. Let me just think.
You didn't think about it, did you?
Oh, no, I've got it. That was it. So I'm going to have to give this 4.5 hobos that went to college for playing basketball out of 10.
Nice one. Well, I guess it's my turn. I was expecting a complete turd, and I got something similar but polished. So you could argue that you can actually polish a turd. You can. That's what this movie is. Which, by the way, before I get into my deliberation, which will be quick, it's just a coincidence. I had it as a little factoid to share with you guys and George, because George is a big, big Twilight Zone fan. As a seminal episode of the original Twilight Zone run, and one of those seminal episodes is called Judgment Night, which George has talked about on his podcast.
Yes.
Remember?
Yeah, now, of course.
There is no connection whatsoever with the plot or the right, nothing else. Just the title. That's right. It. Just the title.
That's it.
Now, about this movie, I just kept thinking about The Warriors. And I think I should have left it for my final deliberation, but that's the sentiment. I think I do feel like this is a 70s piece of fiction. It was written in the 80s and it got made in the 90s. Now, what saves this? Some of the performances. It is 1993. Production started in 1992. This is where Cuba Gooding Jr. was becoming a superstar. I don't know what the fuck, what happened to his agent? Like, what, this guy should still be on top of the world, because he was. And the way he emotes in this, the way he actually overacts in this role a couple of times, Cuba Gooding, is way too animated, and yet it kind of makes the film, at least from that crew, from the good guys. Let's call them the good guys, right? Steven Dorff is a nothing burger. He's interchangeable. Really, like, I like Steven Dorff. Like, one of my favorite movies from the early 2000s, like, end of the 90s, is City of Industry with Harvey Keitel. Nobody remembers that. But anyway, he's really interchangeable in this. So it doesn't matter. Emilio Estevez is Emilio Estevez. But Dennis Leary is amazing in this role. He's mesmerizing. He's hypnotic. Like I said earlier, even if the camera work would have been shit, his performance is still more memorable than I expected, because it doesn't belong in this movie. I dare to call it iconic, you know? Another thing is, I mentioned Michael Wincott earlier, and I know why. It's because this crew, maybe it's the way they're dressed, maybe it's the way they were operating, but it reminds me of the gang in The Crow.
Yeah.
It really does. And the way they're dispatched as well. And I think we're around the same period, right? When was The Crow? 91, 92, 93? What was it?
I would say.
Same year? What year was it?
Yeah.
Can someone check?
I think it's 91.
Well, there you go. We're around the same period. Crow. Same, like, black denim and leather kind of thing, you know. The night
it was
felt
2024
like...
with Bill Sarsgaard, wasn't it?
Oh my god.
Oh. I stand corrected.
Sorry, The Crow was 94. That's good.
94.
94.
A year later.
I wish I had one of those Berettas that Steve was longing for earlier. I could put it in my mouth. It is a 4.5. It's a 5, actually. It's a 5. It was going to be a 4.5. It's a 5. It's a 5 what? It's a 5. It's 5 lines of cocaine that Jeremy Piven must have had every hour in the set. And I'm talking about Jeremy Piven, not the character he plays.
He was 28 when this was filmed.
He looks like he's fucking 40, man. Like,
there is no doubt.
Before we go, I would be remiss if I didn't allow our guest to tell us what he's got going on at the moment.
Oh, yeah. Go to Horror Weekly Podcast, especially if you can stand it, go to the Facebook page, because that's where the community is really, really active. And if you haven't yet, do a review for Screen Divers.
Oh, you're throwing this back at us, man.
I am
a member of that community. The community is referring to is the community that he's built, we've built, which is Friends of Horror Weekly. It is, what, less than a cup of coffee a week. And I got to say, man, you know, you're very humble. You do have a huge following on social media that is attached to the podcast, because you know exactly how to articulate your thoughts when it comes down to deliberating on anything that you like or dislike. And it happens to be in one genre. And you are extremely focused. All the horror that I watched in the past 4 years of my life is due to... You brought me back to a genre that I completely...
It was a Horror Weekly podcast. I'm currently listening to...
Are you listening to the podcast? Well, we're recording this podcast.
In my opinion.
It's the inception.
Oh, Steve. So yeah, it's a phenomenal community that you built. I'm proud to be a member of that community. And anyone here that doesn't believe me, go on social media, look for Horror Weekly, then go to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, Amazon Music, RSS, whatever the fuck you use to listen to your podcast. Chase it. Go listen to Horror Weekly. And if I am wrong, come back. Come back to one of our episodes. Leave a comment going, you were wrong. And I will ignore you and then block you eventually.
Yeah. Can I just say, George, that you are a major influence over Umbar's life, because I was telling him about horror films for the past decade and he ignored me up until... And it turns out that me and you, George, we actually watch very similar, very artistic horror films that are beyond the genre, and he's only believed you over me. So you are... a big influence over on Buzz's life.
Ricky.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm glad he's in the community, but I think it's a joint effort. I think you soften him up and then I put us over the top.
Right, okay, Ricky, now you're fucking teaming
I
up.
I truly believe
you know
that you are correct in your assumption on that.
And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Ricky.
This was Steve.
This is George.
Bye!
What's a college graduate?
Fuck you for getting the last word, man. I'll cut that out, don't worry.
Hold on a second.
Hey, yo, kids.
What's up?
Remember when I used to be dope?
Yeah.
I owned a pocket full of fame.
Well, look what you're doing now.
I know. Well, I know. I lost touch with reality. Now my personality is an unwanted commodity.
Believe
Can't
it.
Believe I used to be Mr. Steve Austin on the mic.
6 million ways
I used to run it. I guess Oscar Goldman got mad. Because I got loose circuits.
So loose. Circus.
I beat
so
a mother goose with the eggs that seem to be
mama don't care.
Read the papers, the headlines say, washed up rapper got some. Lingo's busted while the guitar sways. B-side copy for the radio plays for something. I knew I blew the whole fandango when the drum programmer wore a Kango. Never could be like great fish won't bite bait. Realize that I'm over like clover. No good luckin', so Mace beat the fucking beat. While a teenage fan the heat, I bring it to the clues, paid all my dues. So what's gone dead? Let me use my forehead. Easy, pack it up, man. Let me stop stalling, cause everything I do is like falling.